talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
From the Berlin Wall, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go. How do you measure such an astonishing moment in history?
It was the largest demonstration in East German history. The main square was carpeted with a half million people. The city virtually came to a standstill.
Our top story. The Iron Curtain between East Germany and West Berlin has come tumbling down. East Germany announced today it is opening its borders, allowing its citizens to go anywhere they wish. The future of the Berlin Wall is now up in the air.
The end of the Berlin Wall is a symbol of the end of a divided Europe and the end of the Cold War.
Nobody could believe this was real. It was a miracle.
They were at the door shouting, the wall is open, we walk through the wall.
The day the wall came down will be the most joyful days of my life.
Watching from West Berlin as they've done for several hours, the crowd shout ecstatically, we're coming. Some were taking with them souvenirs of the part of the wall which came down today.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're marking the 35th anniversary of one of the most seismic events of the 20th century, the fall of the Berlin Wall. We'll be exploring why it was built and how it fell and how it ended the Cold War. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Built in August 1961, the Berlin Wall symbolised the Cold War's division between East and West. Constructed by East Germany to stop the exodus of its citizens to the West, the wall stood for nearly 30 years. On the 9th of November 1989, it fell in one of the most dramatic events in modern history. Its collapse not only symbolised the end of the Cold War, but also ignited the reunification of Germany and the spread of democracy across Eastern Europe. And to help me discuss the fall of the Berlin Wall on this, the 35th anniversary, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Patrick Major is Professor of History at the University of Reading and is an expert on Berlin, as well as the political, social and cultural history of the divided Germany. He's completed a significant project on the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall, and he's currently working on the bombing of Berlin during the Second World War. Katja Hoyer is a visiting research fellow at King's College London, an expert on the everyday lives of East Germans and the complexities of life in the GDR. She's the author of Beyond the Wall, East Germany 1949 to 1990. Frederick Taylor is an historian and author and has been instrumental in helping us understand the broader geopolitical implications of the wall's construction and fall. And his books include The Berlin Wall, 13th of August 1961 to the 9th of November 1989, and most recently, 1939, A People's History. Well, you're all very welcome. And Frederick, I might begin with you on a question about those dramatic events in November 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was seen at the time as a major historical event. It's been seen ever since as a pivotal moment in the history of the Cold War. Is it as significant as all of that?
It's complicated. Yes, it was. I mean, it meant the end of communist domination in Central Europe, basically, to finally put an end to it. Because one of the pivotal countries that kept the whole Eastern Bloc together, East Germany, which had been conquered by the Russians in 1945, was very much part of their sphere of influence and a sign of their victory in World War II and their power in the world, was now pretty much doomed to collapse. Of course, we now know that the world that it created, with Russia retreating back into itself and its political system temporarily collapsing, was indeed only temporary. So everything comes back to the situation we've got today, which, of course, 35 years later, is one of tension worse than the Cold War, because we actually have actual war fighting violence in Europe itself. So yes and no. Everything's changed, of course. So yes, it did change everything, but then everything changed again. What it changed to didn't last that long, actually, the unipolar American Western domination of the world for those few years. Yes, that was the immediate consequence, but we've come back to something much more dangerous and insane for a historian. I hate to say it, more interesting.
And Patrick, it was the great symbol of the Cold War, wasn't it? We knew it from photographs, so we knew it from spy novels and movies as well. It was very much this tangible presence that we were aware of, even if we had never seen it, of the divide between East and West.
Yeah, I mean, it's been called, the symbol of the Cold War itself, a concrete symbol, a monument unto itself. Even within a few years of its building in the mid-60s, you get movies like Funeral in Berlin, which actually open, showing you the real war. So I think it really did imprint itself on people's imagination. It was incredibly photogenic, especially for the West. But I think we always have this image of the war from the West. And sometimes it's kind of just as interesting to try and see the way that East Germans saw it. So when I did research into this, a couple of decades ago, clearly 1989 raised lots of alarm bells. It caught, the West by surprise, I think, to some extent. So people like Mrs. Thatcher, the leader of Britain, was wondering whether this was, whether unification of Germany, which automatically seemed to be on the agenda, whether that was a good thing or not. It put things in flux, and I think there was perhaps, as Freddie was saying, maybe this was slightly deceptive, this so-called New World Order, because it didn't last terribly long, really.
And Kasia, how did people in East Germany view the fall of the wall then in November 1989?
Yeah, I mean, it took them by surprise as well. People look at it in hindsight now and think it was obvious, especially in Germany. There's been sort of a narrative that the GDR could never have worked to begin with, and so its fall eventually was inevitable, and thereby the fall of the Berlin Wall was inevitable. And that may well be the case, but up until it actually fell, nobody knew that it was going to happen. So it doesn't really matter who you speak to, from ordinary people to politicians. It did come as a surprise when it actually happened, despite the large demonstrations that had preceded the actual fall of the Berlin Wall in the summer and the autumn of 1989. Regardless of whether you were actually in Berlin or outside of it, it was a huge thing that happened to everybody. A huge kind of moment of transformation, really, in people's lives. Most people, I think, at the time were hugely both euphoric and slightly anxious about it at the same time. It's hard to sort of explain that today, but when obviously the opening of the wall was seen as access to the West, as access to Western goods, to consumerism, people could freely travel again, and Germany was, of course, reunified, and all of these things were celebrated at the time. But many, many people's kind of existences, their jobs, their lives were also at stake at the same time. Around 3/4 of people had to change their jobs or lost it in the first 3 years since reopening. So it's also a huge shock to the system, basically, both in a positive way as well as in a hugely transformative way to many, many people.
And Kasia, things moved so quickly in those months in 1989 and into 1990. And I wonder, did people realise at the time that it would mean the end of the Cold War, that it would mean the reunification of Germany, that it would mean all of these things, or were they things that only emerged very slowly?
Well, to begin with, when the wall first fell, you still had a lot of people in Eastern Germany who felt that they wanted to reform the GDR rather than actually abolish it. I gave a talk last year in Germany, and at the end of the talk, a woman came up and had tears in her eyes, and she said to me, "Can you explain to me why the working class betrayed us in 1989?" And what she was talking about was basically she was one of many intellectuals who had resisted the state, were opposition leaders, and a lot of them wanted reform rather than complete reunification. And when that was suddenly on the ballot paper in the first free elections in 1990, and the West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl basically promised that this would lead to prosperity and let's have quick reunification, quick currency union as well, the people of East Germany voted for that in large numbers. And so unification was done as quickly as it was in a completely democratic way. That's what people voted for. But it wasn't always obvious at the time what this would actually mean, basically giving up any sort of agency really over the way that Germany was reunified. So that many people today on all sides of the political spectrum in East Germany often now describe this as a takeover or an annexation rather than reunification. So most people still think it's an overwhelmingly positive thing, but they often think that it would have been preferable now in hindsight if they'd had a bit more of a say over how these things went, and maybe if they were done in a slightly more structured way.
Patrick, you're an expert on Berlin, and I was wondering if you'd be able to take our listeners back in time to the end of the Second World War when Berlin is divided, because I think people may not have it entirely clear in their heads about how Berlin was divided and the fact that the wall wasn't constructed until 1961. So it was only up for less than 30 years. It's been down for 35, but yet the Cold War story and Berlin goes all the way back to 1945.
Yeah, all of the different occupation sectors in Berlin were actually agreed back in 1944. Initially, it was just going to be the Americans, the British and the Russians, but then the British persuaded the others to let the French have their sector too. So essentially, they divided up the city, and they knew certainly by 1945 who was going to get what sector. But the thing was complicated by the fact that the city of Berlin was deep within the Soviet occupation zone. So there was always this problem that if the Russians wanted to cause trouble for the Western Allies, they could put pressure on the transit route. So there was rail and Autobahn. And the only written agreement they had was about air access. So one of the first sort of big confrontations, of course, the first Berlin crisis in 1948 to 49 resulted in the lift where the Allies had to fly in just basic goods like coal, flour, everything to try and keep the Western sectors going for about a year. You have a situation where there is an open border, so no physical barriers really till about 1952, when some of the roads into the surrounding East Germany get cut off. But if you were a person living in East or West Berlin, you could go and visit your relatives without very much problem at all. Lots of stories of young teenagers from East Germany going to the market on Potsdamer Platz, where they could get jeans, get Western records. Also, the open border was exploited by spies on both sides. So there's a notorious British double agent, George Blake, and he would just hop on a train in West Berlin, an underground train, and then get off at a station just a few stops into East Berlin and then meet his handlers. So the open border became quite a challenge for the East German regime. Of course, the other could happen was that if some East Germans decided that they didn't want to live any longer in East Germany, then they could leave. And the easiest place to leave East Germany was via West Berlin. And then they could get flown out from Tempelhof Airport and then make their way to West Germany. And I think this kind of open border became a real problem, an existential problem for the East German authorities in the 1950s. And they had, you know, it was a real dilemma for them that if they tried to squeeze on the border, panicked some East Germans, and then you get waves of more people wanting to go. And if they didn't do anything about it, then the East Germans tended to not take them very seriously. So essentially, the decision to build a wall, try to deal with this open border, in between East Berlin and West Berlin.
And Frederick, John F. Kennedy was the president of the United States when the wall was constructed, and some have criticized him for maybe showing and expressing a kind of an ambivalence about whether these Germans built a wall or not.
Well, yes. I think that's true of all the Western leaders, but it's particularly Kennedy, of course, was the most important Western leader. It was, they could see it was an awful thing, I mean, this physical barrier and the threat of, you know, violence and death for people who tried to cross it. But on the other hand, A, it was a terrific propaganda coup for the West, actually, for the East Germans had had to do this. It proved the bankruptcy of communism as far as Western propaganda was concerned. And secondly, it kind of started to freeze the situation. There'd been all these toings and froings about Berlin over the past few years, with the Russians trying to force the West to give up its military presence there and turn it into a so-called independent political unit, West Berlin. As one word, West Berlin. Not West Berlin, but West Berlin. And this froze it. Everybody was sort of vaguely, on the case of the West, guiltily rather happy that things had been frozen in this way so that there was much reduced threat of war. In fact, the only time during the entire saga of the construction of the wall and its immediate aftermath was when the East Germans tried to restrict American officials going through into East Berlin without papers, because under the post-war agreement, they didn't have to show papers to go through into East Berlin. It was all considered one open playing field, which any Allied official or soldier could go through without having to identify his or herself. And that's when you had the confrontation at Checkpoint Charlie with American tanks on one side and Russian tanks on the other. So there, American prestige was directly at risk. And that is when, in fact, probably the only moment, really, when there was a threat of war, potentially nuclear war, between Russia and America during the whole scenario. So, yeah, it was a prime piece of hypocrisy. I mean, the Allied commandants in the West had been prepared to issue a very sharp protest when the wall went up, and obviously some of them wouldn't have minded having a go at it with some bulldozers. But once they got on the line to the State Department, the line changed completely. You know, it was, okay, just wait off. We'll figure out some kind of protest and don't do anything. So, yeah, it was a prime example of Western hypocrisy. And, of course, showed weakness in a way. I mean, a year later, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, with Khrushchev testing the West again.
And Checkpoint Charlie became the most famous site there and the most famous crossing point between East Berlin and West Berlin. And why was that? Was it because of its location?
Well, partly it became famous to an extent because of the big confrontation in October 1961 between the American and Russian tanks, where they faced each other immediately across the border. It was kind of a catchy name. It was America's prime point on the crossing, in the crossing routes. And it just caught on, I think. The ones in the British sector and French sectors and so on somehow didn't. But Checkpoint Charlie, catchy name, big confrontations, became the most well-known. And, of course, every time that you see a Cold War spy movie, it's kind of Checkpoint Charlie, isn't it?
Katia, there's a caricature then about what life was like in East Germany and in East Berlin during the period where the wall was constructed. But it is a caricature because it brushes over and ignores the reality of the complexity of life.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a really difficult thing to talk about because obviously you can't focus on the way that most ordinary East Germans kind of carried on with their lives, even after the Berlin Wall was built, without talking about the horrific things that played out directly on the Berlin Wall, where because it was so new and came as a shock to people, it disrupted lives in Berlin so much that many, many people were tempted to cross still at this point in 1961 and 62. And so this is also when you see the most horrific incidences and the highest sort of death toll at the Berlin Wall. Later on, when it becomes more and more sophisticated, it also becomes more difficult to cross. And so fewer people try or are sort of found out in the planning, basically in the planning stages, and are apprehended or intimidated or put in prison rather than outright murdered. But in these early years, 1961, 62, You have horrific cases like Peter Fechter, who was a teenager bricklayer and sort of just during his break realized together with a colleague that some of the bits of the Berlin Wall hadn't been completely bricked up yet. And he tried to flee and basically was shot by border guards in the process and broke down bleeding. On the eastern side still, and nobody could come and rescue him. And he was basically lying there for 55 minutes, bleeding to death, with his cries heard on both sides of the Cold War divide. And those stories have rightly stuck in people's minds. But it's also true that when I interviewed people for my book, older people who were around at the time, a surprising number, and this surprised me when I did these interviews, a surprising number basically said, well, we didn't even know at first what was even going on. Some people were on holiday because it was in August 1961. So some people found out later by listening to the radio or by reading the newspaper. The so-called anti-fascist protection rampart, as the regime called it, had been put up. And then when I asked them, so, you know, what did you make of it? Did you feel that you were now imprisoned? The vast majority of them said it didn't really make a difference to them. Because unless you had relatives in the West, or as was the case in Berlin, where the city was open, as we've just heard, for a long time, and people commuted back and forth, you may have had your, girlfriend or sister or whoever living on the other side, and you didn't bother moving because you didn't have to, and suddenly you were cut off from them. But if that doesn't apply to you because you live in Dresden or by the Baltic Sea, then a lot of people just kind of shrugged and got on with their lives. It's quite telling that there isn't a mass uprising or outrage or resistance against this really on the eastern side. The most loud or the sort of most vocal protest that you hear is actually in West Berlin against this, because the West Berliners are suddenly cut off as well from everywhere and end up basically being the sort of little Western island basically in surrounded by a wall all of a sudden. So both of these sides, you know, exist side by side. And as a historian, it's quite difficult from a moral point of view what you do with that. You know, you can't kind of just have this horrific story on the one side and then talk about how people get on with their ordinary lives. And the third dimension is, of course, that once the regime has locked its people in, it also realizes that it needs to pacify them and make life sort of worth living within the GDR. And so it ends up pouring enormous amounts of money into house building and social measures, like more childcare and a better health system and more holidays internally and that sort of thing. So life also palpably got better for people in the 1960s. And that's another story that you hear from people, is that things actually stabilized because, you know, this brain drain that was going on into the West basically stopped, and you now had doctors and engineers and people like that were suddenly forced to stay and sort of contribute to the GDR, and that stabilized things as well. So it is a really, really complex story that has got many moral pitfalls for everyone who wants to tell it.
Well, tonight we are exploring some of those moral pitfalls as we explore the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about some of the most dramatic escape attempts. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm delighted to be rejoined by my panel of experts, Professor Patrick Major, Professor of History at the University of Reading and an expert on Berlin, as well as the political, social and cultural history of the divided Germany during the Cold War, Katja Hoyer, who's a visiting research fellow at King's College London and the author of Beyond the Wall, East Germany 1949 to 1990, and Frederick Taylor, whose work has been so instrumental in helping us understand the wall's rise and fall. And his books include The Berlin Wall, 13th of August 1961 to the 9th of November 1989. And Frederick, can you tell us about your first visit to Berlin? Because it was when you were a student in 1965.
Indeed. I was 17 and we took a school party over there in the care of our wonderful German teacher. We got on a train and it took us right through East Germany and then over the wall and into West Berlin. It was interesting that now I think about it, that our briefing took place. A young man in a sharp suit with a crew-cut haircut and a strong American-German accent, I now realize was probably CIA, who told us what to expect, and then we were let loose, so to speak. And we went into East Berlin for one day, and it was, I have to say, it was extremely grim. So my whole experience at that time was pretty much in line with what Western propaganda would have told me to expect. And my feelings about that didn't much change when I spent a lot of time in East Germany in the 70s. But it was fascinating. It all felt new, fresh, and kind of violent. Even though I didn't see any violence, the tension was still palpable. And I think people hadn't got used to it on either side of the war, actually. It's very interesting what Cathy said about there being no reaction in East Berlin, or very little reaction in East Berlin after the war went up. Part of the reason is that they did it on late on Saturday night, running into Sunday. In 1953, when there had been anti-communist riots in Berlin and other cities in East Germany, they had started in the factories. But, of course, on Sunday, everybody was off and they were at the beach down at the lake. It was August. It was nice. And that was deliberately planned. So I think people in East Germany were just shell-shocked. Anastasia said things had started to improve. I know it didn't seem that way in 65, but certainly a few years later when I went over there as a postgraduate student, things were definitely much better, I think, for the average East German than they had been 7 or 8 years earlier.
Katya talked about some of those initial escape attempts and that tension there at the wall. And is it true that the Ministry of Defence in East Germany viewed them as criminals, and therefore in some of those early years you see a shoot-to-kill policy for people who are trying to cross over illegally?
The shoot-to-kill policy was never, of course, admitted to by the East German government, but it existed. Yeah, they were seen as traitors. They were seen as criminals. Republikflüchtigen, fleeing the Republic. You know, they were bailing out of the great socialist experiment that was going to save the world. So I think the authorities in East Germany were genuinely outraged that people would do this and behaved accordingly. If you weren't going to have something like the shoot-to-kill policy, then of course people would, you know, get over the wall, swim canals, do whatever they needed to do to get over, and nobody would basically stop them. I mean, at least in the war between the two Berlins, they had things like automatic firing weaponry on the border between East and West Germany. They didn't have things like that between East and West, but they certainly had a shoot-to-kill policy. Something probably like a couple of hundred people died in various ways and for various reasons during the 28 years of the war's existence, which is terrible. Most of that happened in the early years when there, of course, were lots of opportunities in the as yet either uncompleted or unperfected wall. By the late 60s and 70s, they pretty much got it all covered. And people could only really get out through various other means, forged papers, getting into neighboring communist countries that were more lax and escaping over the border through Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia or whatever. But in those early days, lots of people gave it a go to try and get over the border, even after it was clear that the young border guards, mostly, who were probably in most cases as terrified as the people who were trying to escape, would carry out their orders. What else were they supposed to do? They would be severely punished if they didn't. It was a genuinely dreadful kind of moral dilemma for everybody involved. Of course, they were fanatics, you know, on the eastern side. I don't think most people were fanatical. I think most people just got stuck with this job of guarding the border, as they were told they were doing, against the fascists who were going to otherwise swarm all over East Germany and turn it back to Nazism and the capitalist road. So, yeah, it was a dreadful situation, and it existed right up till 1989. It's only really in the last few months that the policy was actually abandoned by the East German government. Like in 1989, the previous 28 years, the shoot-to-kill policy was definitely in force.
And Patrick, there is a wonderful website, berlin.de, where it does provide details, biographies of the people who were shot and killed trying to make that crossing, and about how their lives are remembered and commemorated. And there have been attempts to try and memorialise and remember those who were victims of the wall.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting site, Bernauer Straße, just around the corner from there, which has a little bit of the wall still left. And there is a national memorial there. So I think at the moment there are 140 victims commemorated. But there are also, I think, another 25 border guards commemorated there. The regime. made a big deal out of any shootouts where a border guard would get killed. But it's now become clear in getting access to the files that I think about half of these border guards actually, it was a case of one border guard killing his fellow border guard so that they could actually get away. So it was kind of quite problematic what you actually then did. Did you prosecute somebody on the other side? There was one famous shootout where one of the border guards actually got killed by friendly fire. I mean, I think the important thing is that, you know, propaganda was made out of the escape. So the West would make, you know, lots of headlines if civilians were escaping. So newspapers in West Germany, like Bild Zeitung, which was owned by Axel Springer, and he consciously built his headquarters right next to the Berlin Wall. So this is a statement that this is going to be outpost of free speech in West Berlin. The West would make propaganda about, you know, civilian victims, but then you'd also get newspaper headlines if a border guard got killed in a shootout, perhaps involving West Berlin police, or some of these, if you like, freelance escape helpers were often students who were overtly, you know, studying at the Free University of West Berlin, but what they were doing in their, you know, free time was digging tunnels. So tunnels were the big sort of way of escaping in the 1960s. But by the end of that time, the Stasi had developed, you know, counter-tunneling techniques, microphones. So after that, it tended to be, you know, sometimes trying to get over the wall. There's one case where somebody built their own hot air balloon and then they actually flew out over the wall. There's another case where somebody had already got out to the west, got a microlight aircraft, flew into East Berlin and then picked up his brother on the eastern side and then they just flew out again. But those were really spectacular and rare cases.
And fascinating the way they were going to such lengths to try and to make that escape to the West. Frederick, John F. Kennedy did visit Berlin in June 1963 and made that famous speech considered one of his greatest, and it included that line, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and he showed his empathy and support for the people in Berlin. And you do see attempts then to, I suppose, show support for those who were caught up and trapped by the Berlin Wall.
Well, yes. I mean, it was obviously Kennedy was, apart from anything else, up for re-election the next year. Sadly, he never made it because he was assassinated the following November. But it was important. I mean, immediately after the wall went up, they sent his vice president, Johnson, over to West Berlin, a very colorful character, a large Texan presence in Berlin, which I think did cheer people up. But Kennedy made the speech and there were a lot of people there. And it was a very important stop for him to make. It was a support that had relatively little content other than keeping the status quo. I mean, yes, he inveighed against the wall and its cruelty and so on, all that was perfectly correct. But he didn't do anything to push back in any real way. Yeah, basically, it was showing the statesman visiting Berlin and cheering everybody up. Kennedy was, again, a great presence, not the big Texan presence like Johnson, but a more thoughtful and young, vibrant, handsome presence. And, it was a very important visit. I think he went to Ireland after that. That was a bit more electioneering to show the Irish-Americans his roots.
Absolutely. Katja, I know you're involved in this 4-day exclusive tour where you're taking people around the sites of the Berlin Wall and you're taking them around to show the major places of significance. What do you think are those sites that we need to talk about and that are important in terms of the story?
Well, you know, as we've already heard, there's some bits of the wall itself left. And I think, you know, anybody who's interested in how it worked, how it operated, that is it's a really different thing to stand there and actually see, you know, it basically in the scale that it was, the size, the height, and just the sheer physical structure, basically. So that's something that I think is important. But I've also made a point of making sure that in this four-day tour, we're not just looking at the wall, we're also looking at other ways of exemplifying just how life both within Berlin and East Germany more widely actually worked during the Cold War. So we're also going to look at, for instance, museums that show kind of everyday items, some of the vehicles that people drove and associated with life in East Germany, not least, of course, the Trabant car, which has become somewhat iconic for that. So I think if people are looking to understand what life was like before the fall of the Berlin Wall, both in East Berlin and more widely East Germany, I would encourage people to look at all sorts of sites, different sites further away from the wall as possible. I think the better as well in terms of understanding kind of what it was like not just to live in East Berlin, because I think for most Westerners who visited Cold War East Germany, East Berlin was often the only thing that they saw. And that is a completely unique environment, not least because of the wall. But if you go a bit further out, basically into the surrounding areas where most people lived ultimately, you see quite a sort of different and perhaps more diverse picture of how people lived and how it even worked and how it stayed the case that people were locked into a state effectively for that long, for decades, but up until 1989 lived fairly stable, I would say, lives, where between 1953, where there was a big uprising, and 1989, you don't actually see sort of mass uprisings in the way that, for instance, happen in Poland or in other Eastern European states where the situation was a bit more precarious. So I'd always encourage people to try and kind of look at the bigger picture, as it were.
Patrick, in 1987, another American president, Ronald Reagan, visited the wall and made that famous iconic speech calling on Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down this wall.
Behind me stands a wall that encircles the free sectors of this city, part of a vast system of barriers that divides the entire continent of Europe. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And it was a speech that some of his advisors hadn't wanted him to make, or they hadn't wanted him to say that line, thinking that it wasn't presidential. But as time went on and when the wall fell, that came to be seen as a prophetic speech.
Well, it certainly grabbed headlines. I mean, I think what's interesting is the way that some of the pressure, which is happening at the very top table of this kind of Cold War game, where there are negotiations, where the West is trying to put pressure on the Eastern Bloc to, you know, liberalize things like human rights, and one of those key human rights is freedom of travel. So there are various negotiations going on in the 1980s where Moscow will then put pressure onto East Berlin saying, can you please, you know, allow a few more groups to actually travel more easily? So initially it had been old age pensioners that the state didn't seem to mind if they never came back, so they didn't have to pay their pensions. But gradually what you see happening is mothers or fathers, or what we call first-grade relatives in the West, could individually go and visit them on special occasion. This had to be vetted by the Stasi. And so the Stasi would sometimes, you know, write on the back of the application form, this person comes from dubious social circumstances. So if they had a drink problem or if they were divorced, sometimes that was enough to say no. But there were enough people. It really surprised me that there was something like a million visits in 1987 by Germans to West Germany. But this meant that there was a whole category of East Germans, people who didn't have any relatives in the West, who were automatically excluded from that. But also, if you were a teacher, police, if you were in the military, then you were also automatically excluded. And then that generated a kind of resentment that the people that the state supposedly trusted most were excluded from some of these liberalizations that were taking place.
But I think that there was already, before the actual fall of the wall in 1989, its foundations had begun to crumble because of these kind of small measures that were taking place as a result, really, of things that were happening at the top. But I really think it did take people power on the streets to actually bring the wall down. I think the Western leaders were actually really quite shocked about what happened later on and you know, had some reservations that it could get out of control.
Frederick, I am confused, though, about to what extent people at the highest levels in Britain, in the United States and in France, even in Germany, in the Soviet Union, around the world, realised that this was happening in the 1980s. And to what extent were they caught completely by surprise? Because certainly looking at the newspapers from that time, there wasn't these great predictions that everything was starting to disintegrate. Certainly in the spy novels at the time, it looked like the wall was there and it was going to be a permanent feature, that there really wasn't in a sense that people knew this was coming?
I suppose not. I mean, of course, the East German government talked a good game. I mean, you had Erich Honecker running around shortly before the end of things, saying, no, the war will last another 50 or 100 years. Of course, behind the scenes, you know, like the duck that looks so calm on the surface but is paddling frantically underwater, the East German regime was actually going bust and had been doing for some years. They had a terrific shortage of foreign currency, which they overcame actually slightly to some extent by selling political prisoners to the West for large sums of Deutschmarks. So yes and no. And it was obvious that the Eastern Bloc as a whole was starting to disintegrate around East Germany. I mean, it wasn't in isolation that the East Germans sat there with their wall. Czechoslovakia, Hungary started opening the border in late spring 1989. The Poles were there. They already had basically a post-communist regime coming into view there. I mean, it was all, but I don't think people expected it to fall apart so quickly, partly because, as Katja has said, and Patrick too, the whole situation seemed to have normalized itself inside the country itself. There wasn't much in the way of protest until the autumn, when the serious demonstrations in Leipzig and Dresden to some extent and Jena started to occur. And it's definitely true that although the pressures within East Germany were starting to become intolerable under the surface, so to speak, and there's something happened in 1988-89 where people just decided they'd had enough. They were fed up with the rigged elections. They were fed up with the mediocrities of the lifestyle. They're fed up with not being able to express themselves and to travel. I mean, one thing you must remember is that East Germany had signed up at the Russians' behest, I think, to the Helsinki agreements, which allowed things like freedom of movement. Now, often communist regimes would sign up to these things and, of course, do nothing about them when it came to actually realizing them as part of their domestic policy. But they were pushed and pushed and pushed internationally, and they had to start liberalizing to some extent during the late 70s and early 80s. So the whole thing, it's like, you know, Hemingway said about bankruptcy, it happens slowly and then suddenly. Both the political and the economic bankruptcy in the case of East Germany came together in 1989 and caused a collapse. But yeah, I suppose people weren't expecting it.
Well, tonight we are talking about the dramatic collapse of the Berlin Wall and how that all came about. We're going to take our final break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about those dramatic events in November 1989. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history and we are talking about the rise and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Frederick, we have all of those iconic images of people going out to chip off pieces of the wall and bring them home as souvenirs. And it really was very dramatic, both the imagery, the iconography and the political events themselves.
Yeah, they don't get much more dramatic. The interesting thing about it is right through in the autumn of 1989, when they were holding the enormous demonstrations in Leipzig, there was a point at which the certain people in the East German government, what they called them concrete heads, Betonköpfe, they're really Stalinist types, wanted to, Tiananmen Square had happened in China by that point, and they wanted to do a Tiananmen Square. The Tiananmen option was what they preferred. But basically, their leading police officers simply said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to open fire on crowds and physically destroy these people. I mean, something had happened since the 50s. You had a generation of leadership in the GDR that basically wasn't in favor of using violence against its own people in the kind of way that would have solved the problem there. And the same thing happened on the night of the wall coming down, when it was announced that freedom of travel would be allowed, but it was unclear whether that would be absolutely immediately or in the near future. People swarmed to the border, and basically after a lot of argument and pushing and shoving, the border guard colonel in charge of the border crossing site simply let them through. I mean, they didn't resist, they didn't shoot them, they didn't, after all the 28 years of people being shot for taking that step across into the West, people representing the regime just couldn't do it anymore somehow. It wasn't in their vocabulary anymore to do that. And that, I think, was a terrific change of mentality that presaged, I think, the inevitable collapse of the regime, because ultimately it did provide certain things for its population. It was not a bad life by the standards of the communist Eastern Bloc, but basically the threat of force was always the thing that had stood behind the regime and commanded the obedience of the people that it ruled. That whole threat of force disappeared overnight on November the 9th, 1989, and that is a kind of miracle.
And Katya, I might leave the final word to you then. You do see a huge interest then in the souvenirs of the Berlin Wall then, because it is this great symbol of the Cold War, and people around the world wanted to buy parts of the wall, different sections. There's graffiti that artists get involved in. It is something that everyone wants a piece of.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you go to Berlin today, you can still buy pieces of the Berlin Wall with a bit of graffiti on it in sort of little plastic boxes that you can take home and put on your bookshelf. When you look at where segments of the actual Berlin Wall have been placed all around the world, that's quite remarkable. You know, there's entire bits of it in New York and South Africa, everywhere, basically. They often get given out as sort of symbolic pieces of freedom, really. That's what they stand for on particular occasions when basically Germany gives them to places. So it is quite a remarkable, you know, sort of thing how symbolic this is and what it means to people around the world. And culturally as well, when you think how many films and books have been produced around this. I'm just consulting on a theater play in New York, where basically the wall is the backdrop to a dance performance for sort of a whole evening filling sort of experience with that as the backdrop to it, but in a completely abstract art kind of way in the way that it's being interpreted. So it really has become an enduring symbol of freedom, of, you know, as Frederick just said, the willingness of the people to stand up for themselves, to not take sort of the threat of violence as a sign that things must be endured forever. So those sorts of things, I think, is the enduring legacy really of the wall in psychology.
Well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for joining me tonight to talk about the fall of the Berlin Wall 35 years ago, why it was constructed and how it came to fall. My thanks to Professor Patrick Major of the University of Reading, Katya Hoyer, Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London, and Frederick Taylor, the great author and historian whose book, The Berlin Wall, 13th of August 1961 to 9th of November 1989, did so much to explain the history of the wall to us. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.
Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us. While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see, we take no satisfaction in it. For it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing a people who wish to be joined together. Freedom is indivisible. And when one man is enslaved, all are not free. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.